Please be seated. So an important theme that circles around in all the readings we heard today is what I call, or what's been called, apocalyptic. It's there in all these readings, and I dare say it's something we need to contend with, because if we're honest, it's really what the Old and New Testaments circle around. These writings emerge in one way or another from some sort of apocalyptic consciousness. So let's just, you know, before we stop, we need to define that a little bit, but I want to give you some idea of my trajectory here. I think we need to look at it as either an awaited triumph or, more hopefully, as an act of transformation. So that's where I'm going with this. So apocalypse, what is it? In very simple terms, there is a now which is wrong, unjust, and there is suffering. We are suffering in the present. There's an event that changes everything, and there's a then, a future where rights or wrongs are righted, where injustice becomes justice, and we are thriving, not suffering. That's the construct. A now, an event, and a then. That's the basic thing. And it's all through the readings today. Third Isaiah is the context of returned exiles, which sounds, well, maybe, you know, that's a good thing. They should feel pretty good because they're coming back from exile. But bear in mind, these are people who've been exiled. They've been through the experience of being marched naked through the desert. And all sorts of bad things have happened to them for many generations, right? So it's not, you don't just forget that. And it's not like coming back to rebuild Israel is such an easy job either, right? So this is their context. Zion's renewal is actually not such an easy thing. And so we have expressions like the sound of weeping. Well, that sounds an awful lot like the now, where there's wrongs and injustices. Infants that live but a few days. Not just from normal infant mortality either. Babies were killed. Bear children for calamity. More of the same. And here's an interesting one. Build and another inhabit. So you know they had kind of a thing with Samaritans, a bit of an attitude. Well, that's largely because when they came back from exile, guess who was occupying their former homes, right? That was sort of the urban renewal plan of the then emperor was, we've gotten rid of these people we don't want, let's move these people in to keep, you know, keep productivity up. So the Samaritans were not popular for that reason. Build and another inhabit. Plant and another eat, same idea. And so they're not going by half measures here. What they're envisioning is not just that former things shall not be remembered, but that the serpent is dust, is ashes. In other words, the very curse of the garden is reversed. Like, they got big imaginations, big ambitions. And I really think that is something that we underestimate sometimes, is the sheer imagination and poetic energy of this people. A new heavens and a new earth. This is a vision that is so powerful, it ends up being repurposed in the book of Revelation. It just endures and endures to this day. And I think we need to pause here too and just not get too sort of academic about this and critical of the apocalyptic viewpoint, because bear in mind, when you are stuffed with 500 other of your people in the belly of a ship heading to what will be North America, you don't have much. When you're being marched across a desert with your children and old people dying, you don't have much. And so if you are a people who live largely on hope, well, how are we to criticize that? You know, it's really quite amazing that in that context, they would dare to embrace life, that they would have any commitment to life, that they would be going against the current and clinging to this hope in some kind of promised deliverance. Whether or not that promised deliverance is delusional from a sophisticated and privileged academic or whatever perspective, it's a real thing, and I think we respect it for that reason. Amazing grace. Things like that came from that context. The power and pathos of this sustains us who have not even experienced those kind of things. So it's a good thing, but having said that, in every generation, there is this unhealthy fascination with end times and predictions. And this is the other direction that apocalypticism can so easily go in. And it leads to an abdication of any connection with the here and now. And oddly enough, Thessalonians, which is rightly cited as the source of the Protestant work ethic, there's really something else going on. Now bear in mind, this is 2 Thessalonians. That means Paul's already visited there. And also bear in mind, this is interesting because it's the oldest book in the New Testament. It predates the Gospels and any of the other epistles. This is the oldest record we have of Paul's missionary journeys and his occasional writings to deal with particular problems. A pastor who just kept moving. If it sounds like he keeps changing his story, it's because he has to, because the problems keep changing. So he goes there the first time and he tells them, this is it, you know, the Messiah has arrived, everything's going to change. He gets them all pumped up. And then while he's gone, well, you know, Jesus rose from the dead, but my uncle just died and he's still dead. What's going on? And now our neighbors are throwing rocks through our windows and they don't like what we're doing. This new movement is getting lots of bad feedback. Ironically, the persecuted in the Isaiah context are now the persecutors of this new movement in the Thessalonian context. And so they're kind of freaked out and they think, well, this is it. This is the promised end time. And so they down tools. They just stop working because what's the point? This is all going to be fixed really soon by some cataclysmic event. So, hey, why plant seeds? Why plow fields? So Paul's saying not just idleness is a bad thing, which is kind of what we've derived from it, but actually that this isn't it. And he's kind of saying, as Jesus says in other places, if and when the end comes, believe me, you'll know. Do not try to interpret these little signs that are happening. Trust me, you'll know. Don't worry about it. Get on with life. Plant seeds, plow fields, make babies, work. So there you are. Not unlike generations following, the very first Christian community had these problems. Fast forward, Luke. It sounds like Jesus probably knew about the internet, right? He's predicting things here. He already knew that Louis Armstrong invented the internet. Anyway, hate to disappoint you, but Louis didn't invent the internet, and all the stuff that Jesus predicts here had already happened, right? The temple had already been razed to the ground about a generation earlier. In fact, they'd been living through a succession of their own failed and false leaders. They'd been under a Roman siege resulting in the destruction of the temple. And so these portents and signs were really actually old headlines, right? There's that. But he still says, you'll know it when it's going to happen. And these are only bitty signs that precede the real apocalypse. Oh dear. And then there's the real shocker. All of this is just an opportunity to testify. So we seem to have two visions here of what it means to follow Jesus. There's an awaited utopia, which, by the way, requires the utter destruction of everything as it is. And, you know, we rub our hands, oh boy, because that means someone else is going to get theirs. And the utter destruction and complete replacement of this terrifying and paralyzing prospect, but somehow still delicious. Or the way to follow Jesus is building upon the original creation, which, by the way, the Creator called good, transforming it to a new creation. So an inactive or an active response to the apocalyptic. And I think this is the central message today. I'll make it easy by pointing it out. Whatever negates, discourages engagement with God's world cannot be of God. Whatever negates or discourages engagement with God's world cannot be of God. It's that simple. Or to quote Martin Luther, if tomorrow is the day of judgment, then today I want to plant an apple tree. Keep going. There is suffering, probably always will be suffering. But God has broken into the world, and that's really what we're looking toward in Advent. God breaking into the world with us, Emmanuel, with us. We're called to follow Christ's pattern, to get in on and get on with what God is already doing in the world. And this is not necessarily cataclysmic. It's one cold drink for the thirsty. It's one comfort for the afflicted, one mercy for the oppressed, one confession of our own, one friendship sought, one challenge met, one moment when another person is not objectified, when another person is humanized, one sustained effort to create community. This is not a technique from Jesus. This is a way of following Jesus. You might call it active apocalypticism, or apocalypticism informed by what his appearing conveys about God, about creation, and about our purpose in creation, or how his reappearing that we await invites us into engagement with God's world. And he ends with saying, make up your minds not to prepare your defense in advance. I will give you words. Again, not some magical thing, but just a reminder that our powerlessness to speak in that sense may be our most essential prerequisite, our most essential qualification as participants and partners in recreation, testifying in that sense, one small step at a time. And by this endurance, we do gain our souls.